everybody. This is Brittany Cramsey, and I'm going to be your moderator tonight for your telephone town hall with Senator Lindsey Williams. I'm here with the Senator and her guest, Dr. Arvind Venkat, the President of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. If you have a question for Senator Williams or our guest tonight, please press star 3 at any time on your phone's keypad. And don't worry, I'll remind you of a few other times on our call. So now let's welcome Senator Lindsey Williams.
Thank you, Brittany, and thank you to all of the area residents participating on tonight's call. I'm Senator Lindsey Williams, and I'm holding this live telephone town hall where I'm joined by my special guest, Dr. Arvind Venkat, President of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. We'll be discussing the coronavirus and to answer any questions you may have. This format will allow you to listen in and even ask a question from the comfort of your home. If you would like to ask a question at any time, press 3 on your phone. I just want to start by saying that I scheduled this town hall because a lot of people have questions and are scared about what might happen over the next coming days and weeks. And things are changing really rapidly, and we don't have all the information right now. We've received many questions over the last few days, and my staff has been working tirelessly to get back to each and every one of you while we work remotely for our safety and yours. And we know this is going to have a big impact on both people's health and their economic security, and people are really nervous about that. I just want you to know that we're here to help, and we're going to do our best that we can to help you and answer questions, and that's why we wanted to have this tonight. So without further ado, I want to introduce my guest, Dr. Arvind Venkat, President of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. Of all the terrible stuff, one of the good things is the doctor is my constituent, and over the last couple days, we've got to know each other, and now I get to introduce him to you to answer your questions. So, doctor?
Thank you, Senator Williams, and thank you to everybody who's on the line. As Senator Williams said, my name is Arvind Venkat. I'm an emergency physician here in Pittsburgh at Allegheny General Hospital, and this year I serve as president of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. Emergency physicians are the ones who provide care in emergency departments across the state. Our organization has over 1,800 members, both attending physicians and physicians who are in training in emergency medicine. It's very likely that if you or your family member sought care in an emergency department, that you were treated by one of our members. We form really the true safety net in the state. Under federal law, anybody who presents to an emergency department is entitled to care. And so one of the reasons that I and my colleagues went into emergency medicine was specifically so that we could care for our fellow Pennsylvanians. And with this crisis, the COVID-19 epidemic, we are facing a situation that thankfully we have trained for, that we have prepared and in the past have had to care for patients at the time of pandemic illness. We don't think about it every day, but seasonal flu is something that hits hard in our communities every winter. A few years back when H1N1 was spreading all over the country, it was something that we in emergency departments faced on a daily basis. We are there to care for you, and I have the privilege today of sitting with Senator Williams so that I can answer your questions to the best of my ability about how we can together get through the COVID-19 crisis. And for more information about our organization, you could go to our website, pacep.net, P-A-C-E-P.net, where there's information on COVID-19 that we're constantly updating. We are also on social media as well, so please connect with us on social media for the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians, and we will do our best to try and help you. And in all cases, emergency physicians in the state are there to help you, and I will try and do my best to answer your questions today.
All right, wonderful. Well, welcome both of you and welcome to everybody that's joined us in the last couple of minutes. I think that we should start at the beginning here. We have a good question from Michael, from William. William Marisco, I'm going to put you on the line here in 1 second to ask your question. All right, William, we're live.
William, are you there?
This is Rita, not William.
Oh, I apologize. Rita, what was your question?
My question is, when did this virus start? You mean to tell me nobody knew anything about the virus, all of a sudden just cropped up? How did it develop?
Well, Rita, it's actually a fairly common thing that new viruses and new infectious diseases do emerge. In this case, it came about in the late December, November to December 2019. The first cases were diagnosed in China, but it has since then obviously spread all over the world. Coronaviruses have existed for a long time, and scientists have identified it in a number of cases, but this new coronavirus has just come about in the last 5 to 6 months.
All right, interesting. Well, thank you for that. Let's go to a question that we got online ahead of time. We got about a dozen of those. We have a question from Josh in Pittsburgh who asked what the state is doing to ensure that Pennsylvanians have access to tests.
Well, right now we're trying to get up as much testing as possible. We're not where we want to be, but we are a lot further than we were last week in terms of testing. And doctor, you can answer what to do here in this area if you think you need a test.
Sure. So right now the Department of Health is recommending that the individuals who need to be tested are healthcare providers because of our need to be there for all of our patients. Those who may have come into contact with someone who have clearly been diagnosed with COVID-19, those who may have traveled from an affected area, and that's not just overseas. It also includes now states here in the U.S., such as California and Washington State and New York State. And then those who might be in populations, such as the elderly and those with other underlying medical conditions, who are experiencing symptoms. What we need to recognize is that for the vast majority of people, COVID-19 is an illness that will feel a lot like the flu or other flu-like illnesses, and that for most people, their symptoms will pass. And so one of the messages I would leave you with tonight is that not everybody who is having flu-like symptoms needs to rush out and get a COVID-19 test. We need to make sure that we're working together in order to recognize the importance of social distancing and the importance of using the healthcare system appropriately. And so if you feel like you have severe symptoms, then please seek care. But if you have symptoms that you feel like in other circumstances feels like a virus and that you would expect you would fight off on it your own, that is something that you can do at home without necessarily seeking testing or acute care.
Interesting. Thank you, doctor. We have another medical question here from Kathy in Glenshaw. Kathy, you are live.
Hello?
Kathy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what's your question, Kathy?
It's actually my husband's question. What he wanted to know, if you catch this virus, okay, and then you recover from it, is there a possibility that you could catch it again?
The scientists are still studying that, Kathy. The expectation is that if you have had this illness and fought it off, like with other viruses, that your immune system would have memory of it so that if you confronted it again, you wouldn't get the illness again. But we don't 100% have that answer, which is why we continue to need to be careful.
Okay, let's go back to what you were talking about earlier about medical professionals and healthcare specialists being tested. Someone ahead of time asked us, what are evidence-based practices that have the best results for minimizing risk for patients and workers, particularly those in hospitals? What recommendations do you have?
So the most important recommendations for everybody, not just for healthcare workers, is good hand sanitation. So washing your hands with soap and water vigorously for at least 20 seconds, and maintaining social distancing. So when I came into the office today, I didn't shake hands with Senator Williams. We're sitting apart from each other. And That, those are the two most important things. For healthcare workers, when you come into an emergency department, what is likely in this day and age with COVID-19 is that you will be handed a mask until we're sure that you're not manifesting symptoms of COVID-19. And we will use what's called universal precautions, where we will make sure that we have barriers such as gowns and gloves and face masks if necessary to make sure that patients don't transmit COVID-19 to us and we don't transmit COVID-19 to patients.
Okay, great. Now, I want to remind everybody on the line, if you have a question for either Senator Williams or Dr. Vinquette, you can press *3 at any time, and you'll talk briefly to our screeners, and then we'll get you live here with the two of them. So I want to do another question, actually a three-part question, that we got ahead of time from Lawrence and Glenshaw. He wants to know where testing is being done locally, the best place to get information about the situation locally, and the best information on the current projection of the spread, and any expectations of how long this is going to last. So I guess, actually, that's a four-part question. I'll let either of you get started on that one.
Do you want to take it off, and then I'll follow it?
Sure. So testing locally is still a process in development. Right now, it's being done either at healthcare facilities, and then the tests are being sent to commercial labs or to the State Department of Health. There is an expectation in the next few days to a week that there will be more and more public sites of testing. Our colleagues at UPMC have developed a drive-through testing location on the south side. Right now, that is confined to those individuals who have a doctor prescription for a need for the COVID-19 test. And again, I would go back to what I said before, that not everybody needs a COVID-19 test. In terms of where to get the best information, I have found that the Department of Health, their website has excellent information. The Secretary of Health and the Governor are daily doing updates on this. My organization, the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians, we are constantly updating our website for healthcare providers, but certainly patients can go to our website and see what's there. And our parent organization, the American College of Emergency Physicians, also has information that is excellent and up to date. And the Centers for Disease Control does as well. In terms of the trajectory of this, I think that's up to all of us. The reason that we are going through this crisis is that we need to avoid a spike in very severe cases. And so if we all practice social distancing, if we all avoid unnecessary large crowds, if we practice good hand hygiene, then we can expect that the trajectory of this will flatten, the flattening of the curve that all the experts are talking about, and that gives us the best chance for this to end more quickly. But I don't think anybody can tell you how long this is going to last until we have a better sense that everybody is practicing that social distancing and trying to stop the chain of transmission.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. We have a question now on the line from Michelle. Michelle, you're going to be live to ask your question about elderly people getting food. You are live.
Hi, Senator. Thank you, everyone.
Hi,
what
Senator.
What suggestions do you have to help elderly people who are either afraid or unable to leave their home for grocery shopping or prescriptions?
Right now, I would suggest calling 211 first. They can connect you directly with organizations that are helping to provide those services, whether it be Meals on Wheels or whether it be picking up groceries or picking up prescriptions. We've created a website on our website, senatorlindseywilliams.com/COVID-19, where we're trying to put all sorts of resources there. And as we get community resources, we will list them there. But right now, the best bet is to call United Way's 211 number, and they can connect you directly with something that is close to you.
Okay, great. Now let's talk a little bit about policy and what you're doing at the state level. So Larry Ewing in Wexford had a question. Larry, I'm going to put you live now.
Hello, Senator Williams. Hello, Doc.
Hello.
My question is, what is the state doing to expedite unemployment compensation benefits? My wife just got laid off yesterday.
Well, good thing the governor has waived that. Normally there's a one-week waiting period. He's waived that week waiting period, and they're going to be processing those claims immediately. Now, I don't have an exact estimate on how long it will take you to get the check, but they are working to prioritize this, knowing that people are going to need this money and going to need it soon. And the state workers are working as quick as they can to get those things up and running for you. But we are doing everything we can as a state level to make sure that you get your unemployment compensation. And if you have any trouble, please don't hesitate to reach out to our office at any time, and we can help you along in that process if we need to.
Great. We have a couple of questions now on sanitation and living alone and wiping down surfaces. So I'm going to start with Audrey in Pittsburgh. Audrey, you're alive now. You can ask your question.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate this town home meeting. What I'm interested in, the seniors' centers have been closed for 2 weeks, most of them in the county. And the 31st, we would go back to the center. When the floodgates are open and everyone goes back, well, we've been in a house for 2 weeks. Are we subject to, in order to get this because we've been immune to it, or what? And then plus the fact many of them be riding access where they haven't been riding access. That's the other thing, too. Are we subject to catching the disease by being in the house for so long?
So the transmission of this disease is via droplets. So really with coughing and sneezing and relatively close contact. It's different from some diseases like tuberculosis and measles, which last in the air and on surfaces for extraordinarily long periods of time. So I know the state is going to be taking it step by step on recommendations of reopening facilities, and that includes things like senior centers. What I would say is that when that happens, we need to continue to be very careful with our hygiene. And so making sure that we're maintaining some distancing, make sure that we're not cleaning our hands, and we need to make sure that we are not unnecessarily exposing ourselves to others if we have symptoms.
All right, that's great advice. We have another specific medical question from Bill in Gibsonia. Bill, you are live to ask the doctor a question.
Hello. How is this different than past, I guess we call it pandemics? And when I ask that, I mean we're nearly shutting down all businesses in the county, and we've never done that in the past.
Sure. So the difference, you know, the most recent pandemics that we've confronted have been related to the influenza virus, like H1N1. And the difference from influenza and this coronavirus is on a number of levels. One is that because it's novel, there's no what we call herd immunity in the society. None of us have confronted this virus before, so our ability for our immune system to react to it is largely untested. The best evidence we have is that younger people and those without medical conditions are doing okay, but that's not a completely hard and fast rule. So that's the first thing. The second thing is unlike other influenza pandemics, this COVID-19, for the moment at least, as best as we can tell, has a higher mortality rate, which means that it can affect people to the point of death much more than influenza. Influenza kills about 0.1% of the individuals that it affects. This virus could be anywhere from 0.7 to 3% of individuals. Unlike influenza, we don't have a vaccine. We don't have specific treatments. And so that makes it that much harder for the healthcare system to deal with patients who are acutely ill. And it has a particularly bad effect on the elderly and those who have other underlying medical conditions. So if there is rapid spread in the community, it will completely overwhelm the healthcare system. And that's not just for patients who have this condition. It also will affect the accessibility of healthcare for those with other conditions like heart attacks and strokes and trauma and the like. So for all of those reasons, this is different than previous pandemics and specifically influenza pandemics that we've seen recently.
Well, that was a great answer. That actually answered a bunch of the questions that I'm seeing come in now. I want to thank everybody who's staying on the line and waiting to be screened. I know that there's a lot of you. If anyone on the line also has a question and you want to ask it to either the senator or our doctor here, hit *3 and we'll just have you talk briefly to our screeners before we get you live.
And
I want to ask,
I think that one second there. I think, you know, maybe we can go back a little bit to explaining why we're trying to avoid this peak in symptoms all at the same time and what impact that has on our first responders and our healthcare professionals. What kind of impact, like, are we trying to avoid by doing this social distancing?
Absolutely. So what we are trying to avoid is what has happened in Italy and Iran and China, where they had such a rapid spread in illness that they are essentially having a complete mismatch between resources. And I'm not talking about personnel. I'm talking about beds and ventilators and equipment to be able to care for patients. The whole idea of what we're all hearing about, this idea of flattening the curve, is that we're not going to eliminate this disease. What we're going to do is spread it out over a long enough period of time so that there is both a larger immunity in the community as a whole and that we don't overwhelm the healthcare system with a large number of sick patients. And that's going to essentially cause a crisis in our ability to provide care to everyone who needs it.
All right, great. Now we have another specific question on what to look for and how to avoid the virus. So I'm going to go to Joe and Shaler. Joe, you're live to ask your question.
Hi, thank you. I had a question as far as what specific symptoms we need to look out for, say fever or shortness of breath, and also if a plain cloth face mask would be beneficial or do we need an N95 face mask?
So that's a great question, Joe. The most common symptoms that we see with COVID-19 are fever, cough, and sore throat. There is a minority of patients who also have headaches, vomiting, and diarrhea. Those are obviously pretty common symptoms, and so I take you back to one of my earlier comments of not everybody who has symptoms, which are pretty common with a viral illness, needs to go out and get tested. It's better at that point to isolate yourself. If you get worse, so if you start having shortness of breath, lightheadedness or dizziness, you feel like you're not acting yourself or others saying you're not acting yourself, that is when you absolutely need to seek care so that we can make sure that you're doing okay and to the extent possible to try and call ahead, but that's not always possible and we want you to take care of your health. In terms of masks, the best evidence we have is that wearing a mask when you are asymptomatic is not going to help you.
And what does asymptomatic?
Sorry, I apologize. So if you wear a mask and you have no symptoms, that's what asymptomatic means, I apologize. If you wear that mask, you're not going to prevent yourself from getting the illness because we don't often wear masks in the correct way and we often take them off in the wrong way such that you can, if there's virus on the mask, that's when it can enter your mucous membranes and you can end up catching the illness. So I would not recommend an N95 mask or a cloth mask or any type of mask if you're feeling fine. If you've been diagnosed with this disease or if you're in the household of someone who has this disease, then the recommendation is whoever that patient is, they will be taught how to put on a mask and take off a mask properly to prevent the spread of illness to others. So I hope that answers your question, Joe, but the bottom line is those are the symptoms, pretty common viral symptoms, and not everybody should be wearing a mask.
Okay, great. You know, we actually got several other questions submitted ahead of time about the mask. I think that really answered it well for everybody.
We have a question from Diane in Ross Township about overwhelming hospitals and how to know the right time to go to the ER. So I'm going to put her live. Diana, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Doctor, I know that the staff are not real clear on what, you know, how to handle this. And my question is, especially as being a senior citizen, that I don't want to overwhelm the system if you mention about being a little more serious in the sense of not acting right or whatever that's supposed to mean, or not acting yourself. And even though you present with cough and runny nose and things like that, that sort of sounds like every other kind of, you know, cold or flu. But how sick should a person be before they really feel that they need to go in and really be seen in the emergency room?
So, Diana, I think that's a great question, and I don't think you're going to be 100% happy with my answer, but it's going to be very much on an individual basis. As an emergency physician, I take care of everybody who shows up, and that's what my calling is. And I have found in my practice over a number of years that patients know themselves a heck of a lot better than I do. So if you feel like you're not doing well, then I absolutely would seek emergency care. But putting aside COVID-19, if you have symptoms that you feel like you're managing and you're staying hydrated and you're eating and drinking okay and your family members say that you're acting your normal self, then I would just decide that I'm going to try and isolate myself and go from there. But it's going to be a very individualized decision based on how you feel and what your medical history is.
Well, great. Now, Clifford in Glenshaw has a question that I think a lot of us have had, especially watching news coverage. So, Clifford, you are live now to ask your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I just want to ask about the vaccine. This morning on CBS this morning, I saw a brave woman getting inoculated with a potential vaccine that could defeat this virus. And I was just wondering, they're still saying that it could take a full year to get this vaccine to everybody. And I'm just wondering, if this vaccine works with her, why would it take a whole year to get this vaccine out to everybody that needs it?
So the testing that is going on now for vaccines is it goes through actually three or even four stages. And the stage that is going on now is to make sure that when they inject someone with this potential vaccine, that it doesn't cause harm to that individual. And it's only being done in a very small number of people. So it's amazing how quick they have even developed a vaccine to start what's called a phase one trial, which is what that is, when you just see if it's initially safe, not whether it's effective. But it takes time to track the reactions through each of those stages. And then there are issues with manufacturing and the like to make it widespread available. So that's why it's likely going to be a year to a year and a half at best before there's a vaccine that's available to everybody in the community.
Okay, great. Now, Joanne in Indiana Township has a question about treatment and antibiotics. Joanne, you're live to ask your question.
Yes, I was wondering how effective, since this seems more like a cold and everything, why aren't there more antibiotics used against this, like amoxicillin and penicillin? I was just wondering if that would be effective too.
Sure. So, Joanne, antibiotics like amoxicillin and penicillin are what we use to treat bacterial infections. So things like strep throat, some skin infections, that sort of thing. For viruses, we actually have very few to no effective treatments, and we rely on our immune systems to fight it off. So that's one of the issues with COVID-19 is that even compared to influenza, where there are a couple treatments that have been tested, we really have nothing at this point against COVID-19. And so That's why the social distancing and making sure that we are practicing good hygiene is so important, and also to make sure that our immune systems, if we do get this, are able to fight it off.
Okay, great. I am going to go to a question we have from Michelle in Highland Park about advocacy and things that we can do for people who are staying at home. So, Michelle, you are live now to ask your question.
Hi. I also work in the healthcare field, and I know that, like, I'm a nurse, and I know that on the floor, what we end up is seeing is people concerned. They're making, even before this virus hit, they were making decisions about their health and whether they go see a doctor, depending on whether they felt that they could afford to see a doctor. And I know that I'm in a union. I know that we've been advocating in regards to that. And I was wondering, as a, you know, as a physician, as somebody who's a part of the academy, are you including in your public health plan supporting advocacy for people who are laid off, people who are, you know, suffering from this and trying to decide, do I go, maybe go sick into work, or do I just stay home?
Thanks, Michelle. Was that question for me? Or was it for both of us?
I think it was for both of you.
Okay. So on a state level, you know, there is a lot that we are going to, the House and Senate are going to be doing over the next few weeks to deal with both the health impacts of this, you know, making sure that people have access to the test for free, that, you know, that we're making sure that people have access to the care that they need, but also the economic fallout of businesses being closed and workers maybe being temporarily laid off. There's, unfortunately, I wish I had a better answer for you, but there's a lot up in the air right now, and there's nothing that's not on the table in terms of what we need to do to make sure that all Pennsylvanians are taken care of.
And speaking from the emergency physicians and our advocacy, our complete focus is to make sure that we have the resources we need to care for patients in this crisis. There is no other priority. And so what we have focused on with government is adequate personal protective equipment, sound public messaging about when to seek care and when to try and ride this out at home, and how to make sure that you're able to protect yourself and your family, and to make sure that the resources are there and the equipment is there for caring for patients under all circumstances. So that includes people who are forced to quarantine at home. And so we certainly recognize that we need to be advocating for everybody in this. And this is what happens in pandemic illness is very different than what we usually see every day. And every day, we obviously are all thinking about ourselves and our families, and we're also thinking about society. In pandemic illness, we need to think of those three things almost all together at the same level. Because when we protect society, we're protecting ourselves and our family members as well.
Okay, great. We have a bunch of questions now about underlying illnesses and which groups are particularly high risk. So I'm going to take one of those now. Rita in Sailor, you are live to ask your question.
Yes. Hello, Senator Williams and the doctor. I have a question regarding, I'm in the age group where, you know, I have a more of a chance to contact the coronavirus with underlying medical problems, but they're controlled with my medication and trips to the doctor. Do I have, you know, a less likely chance to develop this coronavirus? I know, you know, you can be exposed to it, but they're mentioning the elderly grouping and these underlying medical conditions, probably like asthma or diabetes. But if you're well controlled at this point and you practice the, you know, the hygiene and, you know, the distance from another person, are you less likely to develop this particular viral, the control, you know, the coronavirus?
So, Rita, that's a great question. I'm going to separate it into two parts. So the question of whether you can get the virus, as best as we can tell, all of us are susceptible to getting the virus. The question is whether you're going to get any form of severe illness. And as the best evidence we have, and it is preliminary evidence, is that it's a combination of age and how severe some of these underlying medical conditions are. So for you, who has a certain age and certain medical conditions that are well controlled, that probably puts you in a more beneficial category than someone with your age who may not have control over those underlying medical conditions. But we really don't have a complete answer, and so that's why the complete focus is on trying to stop the chain of transmission so that we can try and prevent as many people as possible getting the virus in the first place.
All right, so let's keep talking about prevention. Nikki and Allison Park have some questions about self-isolation. So Nikki, you are live to ask your question.
Hi, thank you. And I'm actually going to expand on my original comment. So based on what you're saying, is the best practices are self-isolation, which includes going to grocery stores, going to work. So, for example, today I was at the grocery store, and I was trying to keep with it about 6 feet distance from anyone I was coming into contact with, but people were getting closer to me than I would have liked. And I don't know how to prevent that. There's a chance I have it. There's a chance they have it. So my original question is, at what point do you decide to do self-isolation, knowing that you can come into contact with anybody with the coronavirus? What are best practices around it? What's the length of time? Because I've heard mixed reviews if it should be 2 weeks. And then in addition to that, some offices which have the capabilities to work remotely are not enforcing it. Is that going to be enforced at some point, or is it highly recommended to approach someone more senior or in like an HR organization to say, here's the recommended procedures for both state, CDC, national levels? And I can repeat that because I know that was lengthy.
So I'll try to answer the first part about isolation. So I want to make it clear that, there's a distinction between self-isolation and social distancing. So social distancing is when we try to avoid large crowds, when we try to minimize interaction in any type of large group, when we try to maintain distance, like you said you did at the grocery store, trying to stay 6 feet apart in places where there may be more than a few people there. Isolation and quarantine is really being focused on those who have symptoms, and really even those who've been diagnosed with COVID-19. And that's a much more severe restriction. Quarantine is when the state essentially says you have to stay at home, that you cannot leave your house. And isolation is what happens within your house in terms of trying to confine yourself to a particular room and bathroom so that those who live with you are exposed as little as possible to the illness. So I would say that we all need to use common sense. We all need to use good hand hygiene. We all need to maintain our social distancing. But isolation and quarantine is for a very specific group of people.
And Nikki, for the second part, right now there's a ban in certain areas, including Allegheny County, on bars and restaurants unless they're doing takeout. And the rest from the governor right now is a very strong recommendation to close non-essential businesses. I implore anybody who's on this call who is a business owner to do the best you can to follow the governor's recommendation on that. If you can close, please do so to help flatten the curve. If you can't, perhaps thinking about letting some of your employees telework, split the shifts, trying to keep these larger employers into, you know, something that's smaller. And I know that this is painful, but the more that we do right now, the better this is going to be in the long run, the more chance that we have of flattening the curve. And if we don't get this under control, some of these things that are permissive and strongly encouraged by the governor, we're going to have to make some of these things mandatory. So if we can all be good neighbors and do the best that we can, we will help each other in the long run.
All right, that's great. Now we're getting a couple of questions about the elderly accepting visitors or going to pick up food. I'm going to take one of those now. We have Carol from Canlis Township. Carol, you are live.
Oh, hi. I thank you for this conference. You know, I am self-quarantined because I'm older. Am I able to go out and like go through a drive-through and get food if I wanted to, or should I will stay away from going in and picking up food, but like how unsafe would that be?
So Carol, if you don't have symptoms of this illness, then I think going through a drive-through is fine. I think even in that setting, you want to try and practice social distancing, but it's okay to go to a drive-through and pick up food. The issue becomes if you develop symptoms, that's when things like self-quarantining and isolation may be more appropriate.
And when you do go pick up food, make sure you have some hand sanitizer with you, so when you hand over your money or your credit card, you wash your hands after touching that, because you're both touching that credit card. You know, do things like that before you drive out of the drive-through.
Well, that's really good advice. Now we have another medical question from Maurice in Philadelphia about high-risk groups. So Maurice,
yes.
You're on the line.
Yes, most of my questions have been answered. I really thank you for this forum. So I want to shift it to another question about transmission. Is it definitive that this virus can only be caught by someone who has it, or is there any risk of it being airborne or another way of transmitting it? And what's the best way to avoid contracting it if you're not actually within proximity of someone who has it?
So there isn't any evidence or any significant evidence that this is airborne. So just being in the room of someone who previously was in that room and may have had the virus, that you're going to contract it. There isn't evidence of that. There is some evidence that you don't need to be having a full set of symptoms to be able to transmit this disease to someone else. So if I have a very mild cough or, in a few days away from that, it's possible from interacting with someone where they coughed or sneezed or you shook hands and didn't wash your hands, then it's possible that you might get this illness. So again, what I would emphasize is the need for hand washing, covering your mouth if you're coughing or sneezing, maintaining social distancing. 6 feet is a good distance from someone to say that you're not going to be in their space if they cough or sneeze, and lower the risk that you're going to catch this disease.
Okay, great. Now we have a question about blood donations from Robert in Sailor. Robert, go ahead and ask your question.
Oh, thank you. Senator, doctor, my question is on the blood issue. I've seen it advertised several times for all types of blood to be donated. Now, what if an infected person that doesn't know it yet transmits that through his donation or her donation, and then since it can't be examined right away, it may be weeks or months before that shows up on the new host? What precautions can you say you can take to prevent that from happening?
So the first thing I would say is that we absolutely need people to donate blood because a lot of the large blood drives have been put on hold. We are going to get to a stage where we don't have the blood supply that we need. And anybody who's donating blood is very, very safe. It is done in a sterile way, and it is done in a way that protects everybody involved. To your question about whether you can get the illness via blood donation, there are no cases of that have been reported, of someone getting a blood transfusion and getting COVID-19. And one of the things that the blood donation community is very, very involved in is making sure that the blood supply is safe. So I'd urge everybody, if there is an opportunity and you're able to donate blood, to please do so and to know that you will be safe in doing so, and that will help your neighbor and help your family members if they need a blood donation, a blood transfusion.
Perfect. All right. Now, Charlene in Roth Township has a question about public service announcements that I think Senator Williams is going to have a great answer to. So, Charlene, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, thank you. I happen to be a nurse, and I was wondering whether there is any thought on some funding for public service announcements regarding hand washing, perhaps on the television. Maybe some of the local news networks could put that on at the end of their news hours. And the reason I say that is when I hear government officials and healthcare providers on the television talking about coronavirus, they mention that hand washing is effective. But I would say maybe 10% of the time they also mention it should be for at least 20 seconds, and maybe 30% of the time they might mention or explain how to do it. So I think that might be very effective, since that is one of the basic methods of avoiding transmission.
I think that's a great suggestion, and I'm happy to pass that along. I know that some have been sharing that on their social. I know I personally have shared, anytime I get a new meme from the Department of Health on hand washing, even some of the silly ones about the different songs that you can sing while you're washing your hands so you make sure you do it for the full 20 seconds, I've shared them. I'm going to continue to share them. I encourage everybody who's on this call to share them on their own social networks. And when I, you know, for instance, when I did my robocall out for this event, I included the hand washing recommendations in the robocall. But you're right, the more we can do this, the better for people.
Absolutely. Now, Jim Fraser Township has a question about tests that he saw being sold on Craigslist. Jim, you are live now to ask your question.
Oh, good evening, both you guys. My wife was on Craigslist today, and she seen a gentleman from Cabot selling the COVID-19 test kits, and went for $45 a piece, and I would just urge everybody to stay away from that and go through the proper channels to be tested if you think you have the virus. And second of all, being an asthma patient, what could I expect should I catch this virus?
So Jim, what I would say is, first of all, I think your advice is absolutely correct. Unfortunately, when we face crises like this, there are people who try to scam people with things like Craigslist testing kits and other things, and I'd urge everybody to avoid it. As an asthma patient, because you have an underlying lung condition, you may be at higher risk for having more complications if you get COVID-19 than someone who does not have an underlying lung condition. So again, it's going to be very individual specific. I'd urge you and anybody with asthma to be very careful with their hygiene and their social distancing. And you know your body. If you feel like you're having more severe symptoms, then seek emergency care.
And a little bit of a follow-up on the tests. I know it's a bad idea to buy those tests online, but also if you start seeing either online or in person people taking advantage of the situation, trying to price gouge on hand sanitizer or Clorox wipes, or they're gouging their prices on their hotel where you need to stay near the hospital, anything like that, I would encourage you, Attorney General Josh Shapiro has set up a hotline for price gouging to report it. So that phone number is 717-787-5211. I'm going to say that again. It's 717-787-5211, or you can email it. If you have some photos or screen grabs of what you're seeing online, you can email that to pricegouging@attorneygeneral.gov. That's pricegouging@attorneygeneral.gov. We have this information available on our website. If you didn't get a chance to write that down, you can look there for that information, and it'll be there as well.
Okay, great. I know a lot of people are seeing that now, especially with basic products like toilet paper. Now, we're going to go back to some medical questions. Tristan in Pittsburgh has a question about ibuprofen. Tristan, you should be unmuted. You can ask your question now.
Hello. There's been some research, some papers, journals that came out saying that the virus has this affinity for this H2 protein, which is in the lungs, which explains why it's a respiratory virus. And is it true that ibuprofen upregulates the expression of this gene? And should people who are experiencing a fever or in general take ibuprofen, or should they stay away from ibuprofen and take other drugs like Tylenol instead?
So Tristan, it's a great question, and we don't have a great answer for you. Because this is so new, there are some of these reports that ibuprofen could have some bad effect. There are also reports that ibuprofen is perfectly fine for treating someone with a fever in these conditions. What I can tell you is with my family members, if they had this, I would feel comfortable at this point using either Tylenol or ibuprofen, but I can't tell you that there's a definite scientific answer at this point.
Okay, now let's do another one here from Salish and Wexler. They have a question about holding your breath. Salish, you are live.
Yeah. There has been some mention about being able to breathe for 10 seconds as a test to see if you are, infected with coronavirus. How true is it?
So I have not seen any scientific evidence that that's a valid test to say whether you have coronavirus or not. What I would say is that all of us know when we're breathing comfortably and when we're not breathing comfortably. And so if you're feeling that you're not breathing comfortably and that it's getting more severe, I would say that you need to seek emergency care. But that if you feel like you're breathing comfortably, or how you would if you had an upper respiratory tract infection but otherwise feel fine, then you probably can just ride it out at home.
Okay, now we have a bunch of specific questions, people who are looking for recommendations on infants or certain ages or asthma and diabetes. If somebody has a specific question about their individual circumstance, Dr. Venkat, what would you recommend that they do at this point?
So I think they need to talk to their primary care physician. There's so much variation, not only in the different conditions that people have, but how severe they are and the combination of them, that it's best to get that information and that guidance from your primary care physician.
Okay, excellent. Now we're also getting a couple of questions about the mail. We have one of those from Earl in Indiana Township. Earl, you are live now.
Oh, I'm on. Thank you. I would like to take a Dr. Fauci approach. In other words, better safe than sorry. when my wife goes out to get the mail, I ask her to wash her hands after she's finished opening it. And if somebody delivers a package, I encourage the same thing. The reason for this is I've read studies on how long the virus can last on various surfaces. There's been an NIH lab that has a pre-publication study. And I'll read some of the results to you, if you don't mind. The virus can last up to 3 hours in the air, on copper for 4 hours, on cardboard for 24 hours, and on stainless steel up to 2 or 3 days. Another study also said that since it's a relationship, it's related to SARS, that it can last up to 48 hours on surfaces. In addition to that, I'd like to ask a follow-up question or another question, and that is, I had a people's gas person come into my house yesterday, and before I allowed them to come in, I equipped him with a mask and gloves. And is there any kind of public policy on allowing people into your home or permitting people into your home to do that kind of work without protection? Thank you.
So a lot of the studies about how long the virus can last on surfaces and in the air, those are being done in scientific labs under very controlled conditions. When you're talking about a virus and you're talking about the real world where people, where you have sunlight and you have a number of other different environmental conditions, how long the virus lasts is not completely clear, but it's not likely to be that long. We have a good amount of evidence, unfortunately, from the cases in China and Italy and the like, that it seems to still be what we call droplet transmission with coughing and sneezing and relatively close contact. I think that what you're doing in terms of washing your hands after you open the mail to before you start touching other things in your house is a great practice, and I would encourage everybody to be very good with their hand hygiene. In terms of people coming to do work in your house, I'd like to think that anybody who's coming to do work in your house is not symptomatic, and so I would not automatically recommend that people get gloves and masks that they hand out to anybody who comes into their house. What I would say is if you can minimize your interaction with others to the extent possible, and that when they're in your house, you practice some distancing between you and them, that you will be, that you should be safe.
Okay, great. We had a lot of questions along those lines, so I think that was a really helpful answer for a lot of people. Now we have a question, actually we've gotten several questions about ventilators. So I'm going to go to Cynthia in Brookline, who had one of those. Cynthia, you're live with us now.
First of all, I'd like to thank the senator for reaching out and actually listening to the constituents. Such a beautiful thing. My question is, when we look at flattening the curve, we still are going to have a multiple cases. Do we have enough ventilators to service every hospital across the state of Pennsylvania? And the other thing I'd like to ask is, what is the federal government doing to purchase additional ventilators to help the situation?
So right now, there aren't any reports of shortages of ventilators in Pennsylvania. And even in the places that have been most affected, there has not been reports that we have run out of ventilators. But it is a concern, and that's what is approaching or may have already taken place in China and Italy and Iran, where they did not flatten the curve. So I think that's a cautionary tale for all of us to really be careful with this. In terms of what the federal government is doing, our state emergency physicians organization and our National Emergency Physicians Organization has made note of this and has really advocated with both the state and federal governments to be constantly aware of the need, not only with ventilators, but with other medical equipment, with gowns, with gloves, with masks, with specialized N95 masks, to make sure that we both have an adequate supply and that manufacturers are being told that they have to ramp up production. So what we can all do together is to stop the chain of transmission so that we never get into the situation that has taken place overseas.
All right, that was really helpful. Again, we had some other questions about what we've learned from other countries and how we can improve on what we've seen in places like Italy. So we have another question now on how it's different than SARS in 2002 or a coronavirus strain in 2012 from Neil in McCandless. So I'm going to put Neil on the line now. Neil, go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, thank you. I would like to thank both of you for being on. It's been very helpful. I've been very interested in what you have to say. Previously, Doctor, you compared COVID-19 to influenza outbreaks, and over the past 20 years, we've had two other coronaviruses that, after I looked them up with MARS and, or not MARS, I'm sorry, SARS and MERS coronaviruses, they were much more deadly than this coronavirus seems to be. We did not take the extraordinary precautions back then, but what makes this one so different that we are literally shutting countries down to stop the spread of it?
So, Neil, it's a great question. And with SARS and MERS, there was a lot of work done by the World Health Organization and by the countries affected to really stop the chain of transmission very early on so that it didn't spread as widely as COVID-19 has across the world. You're right to say that the best evidence is that SARS and MERS are more deadly than this, but this also seems to have a combination of being easily transmitted and having a period of time where you may have mild or no symptoms and able to transmit it. And it's one of the strange things in infectious diseases that sometimes a virus that is very, very deadly can be more easily confined than something that may be less deadly but is very easily transmitted. And so drawing on the experience that has taken place in Italy and Iran and China, I think that's what we need to avoid here, because every one of these organisms are very different, even if they're part of the same category of viruses of coronavirus.
Thank you. And thanks everyone who stayed on the line with us. I think we've had a really helpful conversation and managed to answer a lot of questions so far. We have a little bit while left tonight. So we've talked a lot so far about the impact on the elderly and some high-risk groups, including those with diabetes and those with asthma. But we haven't talked much about children and young people who are maybe at risk for the virus. So I'm going to go to Angelique in Trenum, who has a question on that. Angelique,
you're
allowed to ask your question now.
Hi. Thank you, and thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have a child who has severe asthma. He, you know, gets hypoxic with just the common cold, and we struggle with that, and I also work in healthcare. So what do we do for those of us who are out there on the front line working in healthcare and taking care of patients but have, you know, immune-effective children at home?
So, Angelique, first of all, thank you for the work you're doing. You know, we need all the frontline healthcare providers that we can in this crisis, and so thank you for what you're doing. I will not lie to you to say that it's a tough situation. I have children at home, too, that I worry about in terms of caring for patients and bringing this back into our home. There's a lot of guidance out there to healthcare providers in terms of protecting themselves and their family. And I think the most important thing is to use aggressive universal precautions in your work and very aggressive hand hygiene, and that when you come back into the house to be very thorough in terms of how you take off your clothes, laundering it with in a hot water cycle with laundry detergent, and to really make sure that you're being very systematic with that. The good news is that for the most part, even kids with other underlying medical conditions seem to be doing okay in this circumstance, thankfully. But it's hard, and we all need to kind of balance all of those things together. And so that's what I'm practicing with my family if and when I'm caring for patients, how I try to keep my family safe also.
Okay, that's good advice. Now we have a question about rest stops being closed. I know we've seen a lot of news about non-essential businesses being closed and not really sure what that means. So John in Pittsburgh has a specific question on that. John, you are live.
My question is kind of a much lighter question compared to as bad as things are. I'm not a truck driver, but I do understand the need for social distancing and cleanliness and everything else. But right now, I'm concerned our truckers are vital right now. And in the state of Pennsylvania, they're closing down all the rest stops. And I can understand, you know, the distancing. But wouldn't it be kind of nice if the truckers could stop there, use the restrooms, and I'm going to go a step further, all the vending machines and all, you know, other businesses there have, you know, snacks and stuff. But that would be made available to them, and this is, by the way, thank you for doing this, and I hope you do more. I have at least 10 questions, but this is the one on the news today.
Well, thank you, John, for calling. And we're going to try to do as many as we can. And we'll try to also share when some of my other colleagues are having them too, because there's a limit to the amount of lines we can have. So if I'm not having one next week, I'll share the information of when one of my colleagues is having one. But in regards to the rest stop.
On this question, it's this is like the truckers right now are kind of like on the front lines. They're not as critical. They are kind of critical, you know, as to our medical staff.
They are.
But just to make life easier for them for the time being.
They are absolutely critical, John. One of the places I used to work for before I ran for office, I worked for the Teamsters Union. So I worked for a bunch of truckers, and I know how important they are. So the last I had heard from the governor's office was that the truck stops were still open to get gas, and also the convenience stores were open for grab-and-go type of thing. Those food type services were still at least partially available for the truckers. They were moving to closing the inside bathrooms, which I was a little confused about, that they were going to have porta-johns and sanitizing things outside. But I'm going to look into and get a little more guidance from you, and I will share that information on my social media and my website, direct you to PennDOT, because I don't know that piece. But I am very much aware that those truckers are needed to make sure that supplies get back and forth across the state, and we want to make sure that they're able to get gas and food and go to the bathroom, and we want them to be safe, because them being safe on the road means that we're all safe on the road.
Well, thank you so much, Senator Williams, and I think that a lot of us are going to be looking for that information on your social media, and thank you for sharing all the information that you've given us so far. Now, I want to remind everybody on the call that if you have a question, you can press *3 at any point, and we will try to get to you before we finish up here tonight. I want to go to Sandy in Gibsonia, who is a poll worker. Our primary election is coming up on April 28th, and that's sooner rather than later, and I'm sure a lot of people have similar questions. So, Sandy, you're live now to ask your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Williams, for having this. Okay, April 28th is the primary. 3 weeks ago, I got my paper about the training I'm going to have to go for the new machines. I'm not going to any of those trainings right now. Is the governor thinking about canceling or delaying the primary? Because, it's such an important primary, and I take my job very seriously there.
So I know that has come up. I don't know that a decision has not been made yet, but the governor is weighing all that. What I would encourage, because we do need poll workers like you to get trained, but also I would encourage everybody and anybody to go to votespa.com. That's VOTESPA.com, and you can apply for a mail-in ballot before 4/21. And your ballot can be mailed to you directly, and that can ease your peace of mind and also hopefully ease some of the burdens on these poll workers if we happen to have an election day on the same day and it is not delayed, so that there would be less lines and things like that. So please go online to votespa.com to get your mail-in ballot.
That is great. And again, you have until April 21st to get that application in to your county voting office. Now, we have a question from Howard in Fox Chapel about how long it takes to show symptoms and if there's anything else that we can learn from other countries. So, Howard, you are live now. Ask your question.
Okay, thank you. And kudos to all of you for having this conference call. I know this disease increases exponentially, and I know that we're trying to flatten the curve. Exponential growth means that we get a doubling of cases over a certain time period. And my question is, how many days is the time period for doubling the cases for this disease? And I suppose I'd have to add, if unchecked. I know we're trying to lengthen that time period.
So Howard, it's a great question, and it's really in all of our hands. When you talk about exponential growth, you're absolutely right, and it's not just a matter of doubling. It may be tripling, quadrupling, you name it. The best evidence we have is that an infected person can infect 4 other people and that their symptoms may be mild when they're doing that. And so in terms of saying how far the growth can go, I think that's why government is taking the drastic measures that we're in now, rightfully so, so that we can halt that exponential growth.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. And just one short question. Many of these shutdowns are occurring for 14 days. And do we have and do we know what the explicit measures of success would be such that at the end of the month these shutdowns would be lifted? In other words, what are we looking for? What evidence will there be that suggests that this is under enough control to lift the shutdowns?
So I'm going to defer to the epidemiologists on that, they're really the experts to tell government and all of us that we've halted this curve. The reason that 2 weeks has been chosen is that that's kind of viewed as the quarantine period when someone may, if they've developed symptoms, that they're not likely to transmit the virus to someone else. They'll have completed their immune response. And so my readings of this and everything that I've seen in our work as the Emergency Physicians Organization is that we're using 2 weeks as a way to judge where we are, and it doesn't mean at the end of 2 weeks that we're going to be done with this.
Okay, you know, we actually had another question about the 14-day quarantine and what the point of it is, particularly if you have a pre-existing condition. So Tom and Easton wanted to ask you about that. Tom, your line should be live now. Ask
yeah.
away.
Thank you. Thanks for having this conference call. I think it's great. Question I had actually a sort of a three-prong, but the one about the quarantine for 14 days, I self-quarantine. I thought I had I wasn't sure what I had, so I went to my PCP because I had a fever, cough, and headache. So he determined, although he can't do it with x-ray, that I have bronchitis. Unfortunately, January, February, I had pneumonia, too, and that took a few months to get rid of. But what is the purpose? Maybe I'm just a little ignorant on this. What is the purpose after 14 days, and it shows that you're fine, that if you go out after that, you could end up getting the virus? So they're saying you're clean at that, but then maybe a week later you could contract it. How is that helping to flatten that curve?
So, Tom, first of all, I hope you're feeling better soon. And
starting to. Yes, I'm antibiotics. Thank you.
Good. What I would say is that the point of the quarantine is that if you were exposed to someone who had this disease, or if you're manifesting symptoms that could be this disease, that is when you're most likely contagious to others. And so the idea behind the 14-day quarantine is that you should have a period of time when your symptoms have resolved and beyond that to make sure that you can't transmit to others. Because we don't have universal testing, and as I said at the beginning, I don't think we're going to be doing universal testing, we can't say to everybody that you do or do not have COVID-19. And for the most part, for most people, that's okay. But we use the quarantine to make sure that we can cut the chain of illness. But depending on what is causing your bronchitis now, it may be something different that may cause you to have symptoms in the future.
Okay, now in the unfortunate circumstance that someone does contract the virus or knows someone who does, we have some questions about what your first steps are and how you should go about treating it, especially if you're not going to the hospital. So Ed and Glenshaw had that question. I'm going to let him ask it specifically. Ed, you're live now with us. Ask your question.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for calling. Taking my call. If I have flu symptoms, which I do not have right now, but if it were to occur and I'm not feeling well and I'm not knowing if it's just a regular influenza or is it COVID-19, what would be the first initial stages of treatment, in-house treatments, like over-the-counter drugs, or what should I do first?
So Ed, the treatment for yourself is going to be very similar to what you'd have if you had any other viral illness that has upper respiratory symptoms. So You might want to control your fever with things like Tylenol and ibuprofen. You want to stay hydrated with water, Gatorade, that sort of thing. You want to avoid alcohol. Caffeinated beverages can dehydrate you as well. You want to make sure you're getting a good amount of rest, that you're eating well, so that your immune system can fight this off. If you are developing worsening shortness of breath, or you feel like you're getting lightheaded or dizzy, or you can't get around your house, or you feel like you're not acting right, or others are saying, hey, you're not acting yourself, that may be when you need to call your doctor or seek emergency care.
Okay, great. Now we have some other questions for seniors, specifically about stores and local markets opening. So Jim and Shaler, I think you had a good question there. You want to go ahead and ask it?
Yes, Senator Williams. I see where there's certain stores that are setting hours for seniors to do their shopping. I live here in Shaler, and I do shop at the local Giant Eagle Shop and Save. Sometimes I go to Coons. Is there anything on the state to possibly mandate that they set certain hours for seniors? I think that would be a great idea.
Right now, the state hasn't said that. I will make that suggestion, and I heard that earlier today from somebody else. I am going to encourage, like anybody on this call who has a small business, to maybe consider that. And I'm going to pass that recommendation on, because I've gotten that question before about allowing seniors to shop at a certain time to lessen the risk for them. So I'm going to pass that suggestion along. Thank you.
Okay, well, now we have a question about pets from Vina in Sewickley. Vina, you're live to ask your question.
Thanks for taking our call. This conference has been really helpful. The question is, can pets be carriers of corona?
So I don't know that I have a great answer for you. They're really, I've read a couple news stories about this idea, but I don't think there's any great evidence that pets are transmitting it to people or that people are giving this to their pets.
Well, that's some good news we've gotten here tonight. We have a question from Sasha in Pittsburgh about discrimination against the Asian American community. Sasha, you want to go ahead and ask your question?
Hi, yes. I was wondering what both of your recommendations and thoughts were about some of the violence and discrimination that I've seen that's erroneous against Asian American citizens and businesses that are being seen as transmitters of COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, that's horrible. I've heard a little bit about that. And, you know, anybody who seeks to use this health crisis to divide us, you know, shame on them. This is not any one particular nationality's fault or problem, and it's all of us who are in this together. So, you know, you can still, you know, order takeout from your local Chinese restaurant. You know, please patronize that small business and get that delivery to make sure that we set a good example for our neighbors that this is not the time to be discriminating against each other. This is the time to be supporting and encouraging each other, because that's the only way that we're going to get through this.
And I would say medically, there is absolutely no evidence that this disease is confined to a particular race or ethnicity. It's very clear that it's affecting everybody. And so this is something that we absolutely need to avoid.
Thank you for that. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left here, but if you still have a question, you can hit *3 and get in the queue. If we do not get to your question tonight, someone from Senator Williams' office will try to get back to you as soon as possible. We have all of your contact information. Now, I want to go to Gail and McCandless, who has a question about cleaning your own house, especially if you live alone. So, Gail, you're live now. Go ahead and ask.
Hi, Thank you very much. Well, I'm 76 and I live by myself. Do I need to wipe off counters, doorknobs, etc., even if I don't go out that day and no one else is here?
So, Gail, I would just use common sense. I think if you haven't had interaction with others and you're staying at home and you're keeping your home clean, I don't think you have to go overboard to clean off surfaces, 24/7. I think you you just want to use common sense.
And for me, I live by myself, but it's me in an apartment upstairs. And so what I've done is I've wiped off the front door when I come in and out, because I'm not the only one touching it. My neighbor's also touching it. But then I'm not wiping every surface on the inside of my house. But I'm wiping and being careful with those things that I'm touching and bringing into my house from the outside.
All right, great. Thank you for that question. Dr. Vinkette and Senator Williams, I think we're about ready to wrap up here.
Okay. Well, thank you all so much for participating in the telephone town hall discussion. To those who listened in and to those who shared their opinions and asked questions, it's been a really great discussion. And thank you to my guest, Dr. Arvind Vinkette, president of the Pennsylvania College of Emergency Physicians. If you didn't have a chance to ask your question, please remain on the line. You'll be able to leave your question on a voicemail for me, and we'll get back to you. And as always, my office, my staff are here with any additional questions or concerns, especially as this continues. We may not be working in the office, but we are working remotely, and they've been on the phone and on their emails all day and will continue to be. And I'm here to help you. So if you have any additional questions or concerns, please call my office at 412-364-0469 or visit my website, SenatorLindseyWilliams.com. Have a good night, everybody.
All right. Thank you for participating in Senator Lindsey Williams' telephone town hall. You've all been a great audience, and we thank you for sharing our evening with us.